Welcome back. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Just as the presidential race is in its final push before the November 8th election, movie makers are releasing films before the end of the year so that they can be considered for this season's awards nomination. So we'll talk a little bit about that with our movie mavens, Anne Hornaday, who joins me in the studio. She's the film critic for The Washington Post. Hey, Anne.
Hello, Tom. Fine, thank you.
And Jed Dietz is on the line with us from Martha's Vineyard, where he is finishing up a little summer idyll. How are things on the vineyard? You survived Hermine, right? Is that how you say it? The name of the storm last week?
It is. Yeah. Yep. We survived it, and we've had lots of good movies up here. It's been fun.
Terrific. So let's talk a little bit about the summer as it now has come to a close with the passing of last week's Labor Day holiday. I mean, Anne, you wrote a piece about the hits and misses this summer. More misses than hits, it seems. I mean, the big studios in particular had some misfires.
Yes, it just didn't work, did they? I mean, and they were dramatic. I mean, I think what people were remarking on was just how big the misses were. You know, the ones I sort of focused on, maybe fairly or unfairly, were the Batman movies, the DC Comics movies that came out. Batman versus Superman actually came out in the spring, but it was almost the warning shot across the bow of summer, which was, I just think, sort of an unmitigated disappointment, you know, for viewers, for critics. I think, you know, it made money at the box office, but it was enjoying or suffering these vertiginous drops, which usually indicates not much audience support for something. And the same thing happened with Suicide Squad, which I also really didn't like. So,
because that's what happens when a movie opens really big.
Yeah.
That's one thing.
Sure.
And maybe that's
all the diehard fans
are going to go to that first weekend. But then if that second weekend doesn't sustain...
Look at that second week drop-off, and that tells you a lot about goodwill, and it also tells you a lot about what they can plan going forward in terms of, you know, when does that goodwill run out?
And I think it also has a lot to do with the follow-up sales, you know, the whole life of the film, which we don't know yet on these movies, because, as Anne said, I mean, Captain America and Batman and Superman were in the billion-dollar range worldwide, got really beat up by critics and fell very fast, both of them. Suicide Squad a little less so.
But they're still going to gross $1 billion plus, though? I mean, because of the international sales and stuff.
Captain America's already done $1.2 billion and, you know, $873 million for Batman and Superman.
And I would say, I'm not sure that critics were that tough on Captain America. I mean, it may not have been our favorite, but I do think That's Disney is doing a much better job. And the focus of my little essay was really that the studios, because they're so dependent on these pre-existing properties so that they can get these pre-sold audiences that Tom was talking about, you know, their mandate has become intellectual property management. You know, I mean, they have to, and I think what they forget is that, or the worst of them forget, is that that's every bit a creative task as anything, and they need to be creative about it and think creatively and think as filmmakers first. And I personally think Disney's doing a better job of that than Warner Brothers.
Yeah, and in your piece in the Post, you said that back in 2014, the chief executive of Warner Brothers, Kevin Tsujihara, how do I say his name? Tsujihara, something like that, told a stockholders meeting that they had 10, count them, 10 movies based on stuff like Superman and Batman and, you know, Harry Potter and Lego and stuff, and they didn't even have scripts for it.
Yeah.
I mean, and this is between 2014 and 2020, right. So, I mean, this is over a period
of time.
And to
be fair, he's not the only one, and I really did pick on him. I'm a nice person, and I don't ever want to, you know, single people, but I just feel like, again, they have... It just the fact that they had Batman versus Superman and Suicide Squad back to back that were both, to me, just so poorly executed that I just felt like something's wrong. And, you know, to be honest with you, I've heard from their representatives and they know something's wrong. I mean, they're aware of this and they're trying to fix it. And they've got, you know, like they have the Wonder Woman movie coming up that really looks promising. They just signed on. I think rumor has it. I don't know if it's been confirmed, but Doug Liman might be doing one of these DC Comics movies, and he's a really solid filmmaker. You know, so it's not like they're not aware of this.
So, Jed, for example, there's a remake of Ben-Hur. I mean, was there some hue and cry for another Ben-Hur?
Apparently not, Tom.
from the receipts at the gate. But I mean, I wonder, can you speculate as to the thinking that went into the studio's minds when they said, yep, this is the perfect time, the perfect summer for another Ben-Hur?
Well, there had been a couple. Both of them did very well, I mean, back in the 30s and then the Charlton Heston one. And so, so it had that kind of a track record, and it had been a while since Charlton Heston, Stephen Boyd, William Wyler made that movie. And I think they added this sort of even more sort of a religious overlay, and I think the Passion of the Christ had surprised everybody and did so well. So I think that is what added up to the business side of it. The stunning thing is a movie that cost well over $100 million to make, and I'm not even counting the marketing money at that point, has so far, is basically over at this point, and it's grossed $43 million, which means the studio on their $100 million-plus bet has made back 20-something. And it's, I mean, those disasters don't come along that often. I mean,
well, and you know, and it reminds me so much of the last time something like that was Lone Ranger, which is sort of similar in terms of this really archaic property that they feel like, well, we'll just stick Johnny Depp in it. And, you know, it's just like there's this kind of lazy, I think it's just sort of lazy thinking and assumptions that they just cannot afford to be making.
And we're not going to blame Morgan Freeman for being stuck in Ben-Hur and not making it happen, right?
No.
Or a great, or sort of like a weird, you know, like a state-of-the-art chariot race, whatever that entails.
And you get these two animated movies that are common denominator movie, you know, meant to be great big movies, Finding Dory and Secret Life of Pets. Mm-hmm. Which I think had some of the quality Anne was talking about in that article. And Finding Dory isn't quite there, but it's going to do $1.2 billion worldwide. And Secret Life of Pets is $700 million plus, you know? So I think, and there are these little horror movies that have snuck out. Shallows with Blake Lively that, I don't know what it cost, under $20 million for sure. And it's done almost $100 million.
And Don't Breathe just now.
Yeah, Don't Breathe. And even Conjuring 2.
Yes.
So it's
tough to predict, isn't it? I mean, obviously, Ben-Hur might have been a good bet and that one didn't work. But, others, might have seemed like long shots. It's interesting. Of course, The Secret Life of Pets. I haven't seen this movie, except I've had a lot of dogs in my life. Pets do not have a secret life. I mean, they made that part up. I'm just on the record here. I'd like to say,
pets
do not have. Yeah. Spoiler alert: the dog goes to sleep, stays asleep all day until I come home. Then she wakes up. On 81, it's Maryland Morning. We've got our movie mavens.
That's right.
We've got our movie mavens with us: Jed Dietz from the Maryland Film Festival and Anne Hornaday from the Washington Post. Let's talk about a movie that none of us have seen, but it's bound to have quite a splash because of the subject. This is a movie called Snowden, and it's Oliver Stone, who has obviously directed other incredible movies. JFK, he was a big conspiracy theorist about that. It opens at the Charles Theater here in Baltimore on Wednesday night, and it's a special screening. At the end of the film, they're going to link into a Q&A with Oliver Stone and Mr. Snowden from New York. So this happens Wednesday night at the Charles. So Anne, I mean, a documentary about, contemporary issues and contemporary people. It was obviously fraught with all sorts of problems in that you don't have an historical perspective. But what are you expecting? I mean, you haven't seen it yet, obviously, but do you walk into the theater knowing it's Oliver Stone and knowing it's Edward Snowden, and we know, something about Edward Snowden, but certainly not as much as people are going to know about him 20 years from now. What are you looking forward to?
Oh, I can't wait. I think this is a match made in heaven. And there was a documentary about Snowden, Laura Poitras's brilliant Citizen Four. So we did get, I think, a really candid, very intimate glimpse of this young man. And I cannot wait to see what Oliver Stone does with this material. And I think, it's easy to dismiss Oliver Stone as like Mr. Conspiracy Guy, but he really is. First of all, I think he's a great filmmaker. I mean, he really understands cinematic language. I think he understands visual storytelling. He's just in the top tier of filmmakers in terms of just the facility with the cinematic language. So for that alone, I'm looking forward to it because I just think he's such an interesting artist. And then just this material is so perfect for him. And Joseph Gordon-Levitt happens to be playing Snowden, and I'm very much looking forward to that. I think that's a brilliant piece of casting. So.
Yep.
I mean, all of my hopes are really up for this. I think that I really hope, and I wouldn't be surprised if this would sort of find Stone back at the top of his game and like really finding the material that's just right in the pocket.
Yeah. So Jed, we do have this Laura Poitras documentary, which is really quite extraordinary. And Snowden himself was in that. This is going to be a fictionalized version of it. I mean, a narrative version of it. What will we... what can Stone do that Laura Poitras couldn't do with the real thing?
It's a phenomenal movie, and you should run and everybody should go rent it and see it. It's incredible, Citizen Four. But it's called Citizen Four because when she went to Hong Kong to film him, she didn't even know who he was. And that's why it's called Citizen Four, because that was the name he was using in his emails. And I think the revelation at the core of it however you feel about him and the disclosing of facts that he did, I think what she reveals is that his motivation is very different than a Julian Assange or a Manning or somebody who just dumps a whole bunch of data out there no matter what. We don't care what the consequences are. He cared very deeply about the consequences. He came out of the security community. He cares a lot about security. He believes the threats. But what he wanted people to understand was this idea that the surveillance amount that's going on has not been discussed and, in fact, has been actively suppressed. And we just, as a citizenry, he felt we just needed to know that. And where Stone goes with this, we'll find. I mean, I'm with Ann. I mean, you sort of can't wait because of his background in filmmaking and his energy in filmmaking and his skills. But I think Snowden is the right one of these guys to of the various people who are hacking and getting information, spilling information out. This is the guy who's trying to do it in a very careful way. And again, I say that with all respect to people who believe he's really seriously violated national security and laws. So I think the movie, you're going to be totally curious to see it, and I hope it works.
And it's definitely a very different story than Julian Assange and WikiLeaks.
Oh, it's night and day. And that's part of one of the points of Citizen Four is that's why he went through journalists. I mean, that was a conscious decision on his part because he said, I'm not qualified. You're the gatekeepers. I mean, so he was actually sort of respecting old school legacy journalism values and gatekeeping values by going to Glenn Greenwald and Laura Poitras.
Let's take a look at a couple of other titles before we take a break. Hell or High Water. It's a contemporary Western. Mm-hmm. It's at the Landmark Theater here in Baltimore. I guess you've both seen it. Anne, what did you think?
Oh, I was just utterly blown away by this movie. And I went in a little bit skeptical. Like you said, it's a contemporary Western about guys on a bank robbing spree in West Texas being tailed by a sheriff, and immediately your mind goes to No Country for Old Men, and immediately you think, who could ever outdo that, and why do we need another derivative version of that same story? And instead, it's genuinely fresh, it's very timely, it's very much set in the current social and economic world that we live in, and it's informed by that. It's sort of this post-financial meltdown movie. Ben Foster and Chris Pine, who was, to me, the revelation of the film. I mean, we know him as Captain Kirk in Star Trek, and he was wonderful in Into the Woods. Mm-hmm. But this is just a terrific performance from him. And then Jeff Bridges, who is just magical as the sheriff. So all of those familiar elements are there, but somehow they've been sort of alchemized into something that feels really fresh and new. And it's just been beautifully directed by David McKenzie. And it was written by the same guy that did Sicario. So for people out there that liked that movie, they'll understand the tone of this. I mean, it's very tough and very real and funny, too.
Mm-hmm. And Jed, you liked it as well, huh?
Oh, I thought it was terrific. There's a scene in a restaurant The way it's acted and written is worth the price of admission.
Agreed.
The other thing I will say, it was all filmed actually in New Mexico, but it takes place in these small towns in Texas. And the first robbery at the very beginning of the film takes place in the town in Texas in which the last picture show took place.
I did not know that.
And that was Jeff Bridges' first movie.
Oh, Jed. Good on you, mate. Oh, I didn't know this. No. And now I want to see it again.
That's what I call a segue there. Indeed, it's pretty good. That's pretty good. It's impressive. All right, so Hell or High Water, it's at the Landmark Theater. It's interesting because, you know, this has gotten a lot of really good press. And like
wonderful.
You, I'm a little suspicious. Oh, yeah. Do we need another Western?
Yeah, and then they go and do a good one, and then you think, thank goodness for that.
Good matters, you know. Before we take a break, Birth of a Nation. Of course, this is a very famous title in the history of film. There's a new one by a director who's not been, immune from criticism because of his personal life, a guy named Nate Parker. Takes place in the antebellum South. It's about Nat Turner. What'd you think, Ann?
Well, you know, it's the writing and directing debut of Nate Parker, and he had labored for years to get this movie off the ground. So you just have to respect the effort of it. I mean, it's just this enormous undertaking. He also stars in it. He plays Nat Turner. I think it's not a perfect film. I think it has some drawbacks, not even drawbacks, but it has the flaws of any first film. I mean, it's definitely a first film, but it's been very handsomely produced. The performances are excellent, and it's the story that people have been waiting for a really long time. I mean, it has a lot of historical meaning. And I think, you know, despite the controversy that has erupted around his past, people are grateful to have this finally see the light of day.
Mm-hmm. And Jed, from a PR perspective, I mean, here's a first-time filmmaker, an African-American, accused of sexual assault. He was not convicted of any crime. This is back in the 90s, I guess.
Yeah.
And that was the buzz on this movie before the movie even came out. What does that mean? How should we understand this?
Yeah, I don't know yet, because the calculation, when this played at Sundance, it was the runaway hit at Sundance. It got purchased by the rumored to be, nobody knows ever these big actual facts, but for the most amount of money by a lot in the history of Sundance. And there, of course, a lot of hit films have come out of there. And then it was immediately, we would have loved to have had it at the festival, and Fox Searchlight, who bought it, decided to bring it out in the fall for award season, I think largely understanding the guilt and concern in Hollywood about the whole Oscar so white thing. And it seemed like the perfect vehicle, just pure PR. I think Fox Searchlight also cared about the movie. But and now that's been obviously compromised to some degree. How much we're going to find out.
Yeah, we'll find out.
We'll find out more. It's great that he got this film made.
And we will find out more about movies with Jed Dietz, who joins us from Martha's Vineyard, and Hornaday here with me in the studio from The Washington Post after a break for the news. And first, a Baltimore story with Gil Sandler.
If you want to join in on the conversation, go to our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning, and make a comment. We'd love to hear from you. You can also check out our audio archives there and learn more about what you just heard, or even make a pledge to support local programming. Again, that's at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
Welcome back. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. We're going to continue now with our movie mavens for Maryland Morning Movie Mayhem. Anne Hornaday from The Washington Post is here. Anne, welcome back.
Thank you.
After that lengthy break for Gil Sandler and the news, and Jed Dietz, who joins us from Martha's Vineyard up in Massachusetts. Jed, welcome back again.
Thanks so much.
I want to talk to you both about a piece, Anne, that you wrote, and the title of the essay was, Has There Been an Obama Effect? Mm-hmm. In Hollywood. So I saw South Side with you. I guess we've all seen this, which is a fictional depiction of the first date in Chicago in the 80s between Barack Obama and Michelle Robinson at the time. I thought it was charming, not sentimental. It didn't go overboard in any, you know, hokey, corny way. Linnell, my wife, thought it was terrific as well. There's a scene where they have an ice cream cone. I wept my eyes out at that scene. I was so happy to have that happen. But, Anne, this is not the only movie that's going to be made about this particular president, is it?
Oh, no. This is just the beginning. And it's so interesting that it came out now. And it's also interesting that at the Toronto Festival, which is getting underway this week, we're going to see another movie about President Obama's early life. It's a movie called Barry about his years at Columbia University. So it is, the myth making has already begun. But I agree with you that the great strength of South Side with You is that it tiptoes up to hagiography, but I don't think it completely tips in. I think the filmmaker, to his credit, just keeps it very tightly focused on these two young people sort of discovering each other and discovering themselves throughout this day-long conversation. So it's a lot more unforced, you know, than some sort of, you know, he's not putting a lot of spin on the ball, which I really appreciated. But what I was looking at in the essay was just sort of the last 8 years. I do think, whether it's coincidence or would never argue it's cause and effect, but I do think that the iconographic power of having the Obama family in the White House, just that image, has just been extremely potent, you know, for everyone. And then we've had this kind of contemporaneous movement within the film community of all these new voices coming to the fore, people like Ava DuVernay and Ryan Coogler and Dee Reese and Barry Jenkins and Nate Parker, who
we
just talked about.
Talking about a little bit ago.
And these just conversations about representation that Oscar So White was really helping us have, about representation in front of the camera, behind the camera, what stories are being told. To me, they all felt of a piece. They all felt of a piece with the Obama administration in terms of just what we have come to expect. you know, what does America look like now? And what do we look like as a people? And what are the, you know, what constitutes our stories?
Yeah, Jeb, one of the things that struck me about Southside with you is that in the very first shot of the actor playing Mr. Obama, it's a little dark, it's a little fuzzy and stuff, but when you see that actor come on the screen, he said, oh my Lord, they found the guy who looks exactly like Barack
sounded,
Obama.
It sounds like.
And then when you look at him through the movie and a little closer, you sort of understand, oh yes, this is an actor. And the same thing for the woman who plays Michelle Obama. Mm-hmm. And the fact that the President Obama is a sitting president, that really affects, I think, one's understanding and appreciation of this movie. And the other movies are going to happen after his term is over. I mean, first of all, Jed, what did you think of the movie? And what do you think it means that it's being released, you know, while he's still got, 4 months left in office?
And, of course, the Obamas cooperated not one bit with this movie. I mean, so this is all fiction. I mean, there was this first encounter between the two of them that they both written about a little bit. But really, the whole thing is made up. I saw it at Sundance, and I went in with real skepticism. It was one of these Sundance big events at the big theater, and John Legend, who produced it, and Chrissy Teigen were there, and I just sort of braced myself for something that didn't work. And what you guys said, I totally agree with you, that it was just totally charming. And I think what Anne wrote about and was talking about just a minute ago, in this era, it can't be overstated, is this idea that the racial stereotypes, hopefully in both directions, are now breaking down. And artists are starting to make stories and paintings and sculpture about themselves and about other views of people that get us beyond the stereotypes and getting to know each other much more on a human level. And of course, this little movie is about getting to know somebody on a human level.
On 881, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall in the studio with Anne Hornaday, the film critic for The Washington Post, and on the line from Martha's Vineyard in Massachusetts is Jed Dietz. Anne, you wrote that Hollywood's addiction to normative whiteness looks particularly pathetic in this particular climate. I mean, it's not just because of the movies that are, you know, featuring more people of color, but the fact that we do have a president with African ancestry in office, that to have this notion that, you know, the world is white just doesn't fly anymore.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that gets to audience expectations, and then that will circle around, and we've already seen it to the box office. And I feel like that's one of the reasons that the Fast and Furious franchise is so successful, is that it was from the beginning, it was a very, again, unforced, organically diverse and inclusive cast. They didn't make a big deal of, you know, it didn't feel patronizing. It didn't feel like box checking. It was just this is the way the world is. This is what life looks like. And it's purely in the interest of realism and authenticity and honesty. And to the degree that film makers and film studios continue to ignore that, they are going to alienate the audience more than ever. So I just think it's not only artistically necessary, but I think it really will have commercial consequences.
And Jed, Ava DuVernay has become the first woman, certainly the first woman of color, to direct a huge blockbuster movie. She's been penned to direct a $100 million budget movie. And now I'm blanking on the
word.
It's called Wrinkle in Time.
Yeah.
So, you know, is the business part of it changing? I mean, we had, you know, 12 Years a Slave win Oscars and stuff, and then the very next year, there were no people of color, you know, in the list of nominations. So it's not a direct trajectory north, is it?
No, I don't think it's ever one straight line, but art doesn't work that way, you know. But I think it's clearly a trend. I mean, clearly something is happening, and we're in the middle of it or at the beginning stages of it. And there's a you know, the big hit that people have been writing about last weekend from Telluride was a movie by Barry Jenkins, who's a young African-American filmmaker who was at the festival with a small, beautiful film called Medicine for Melancholy. And this new film is called Moonlight. And one of the themes of it is sort of homosexuality in the African-American community. And, I mean, it's gotten incredible press already. So this vector is just starting, and it's very exciting, like Anne's.
Yeah, and we'll have a link to Anne's piece on our website, because it draws some really interesting conclusions about the effect of the Obamas on the arts in general, I mean, and the movies in particular. All right, good to see you both. Appreciate it very much, and we'll see you next month.
Thanks.
Ted Dietz is the founder and director of the Maryland Film Festival, and Hornaday is the film critic for the Washington Post. We've got links to the festival and Ann's movie reviews on our website, as I said, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Maryland Morning's director, engineer, and co-host is Nathan Sterner. The show is produced by Rob Sivak, Bridget Armstrong, and Kathleen Cahill, with production assistance from Lauren Ferguson. Austin Coughlin from Clean Cuts wrote and recorded the Maryland Morning theme music. Coffee for our guests provided by Zeke's Coffee in Lauraville. You can find them online at zekescoffee.com. That's it for us today. Coming up Monday, Nathan Sterner has a conversation about fracking in Maryland with Dr. Brian Schwartz from the Bloomberg School of Public Health at Johns Hopkins and Senator Bobby Zirkin. Alan Walden, the Republican candidate for mayor of Baltimore, will be here as well, and theater critic J. Wynn Russick will join me for a review of the new show at the Ford's Theater in Washington. Until then, I'm Tom Hall. Thanks so much for listening. Garrison Keillor's up next with the Writer's Almanac. Have a great weekend.